Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. The focus of this edition is on the contents of the single most important thing you possess, your mind, and the education it takes to thrive in this world. We begin with the details of a survey of 1,000 registered Kentucky voters interviewed statewide in June by phone, both landline and cell. It finds K-12 education among Kentuckians' top three priorities behind health care and jobs in the economy. The poll was conducted for the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, an independent, nonpartisan, citizen-led organization that is working to improve education in Kentucky. You may have read about this poll in the news, but we wanted to dig a little more deeply into the findings. And here to help with that is the Pritchard Committee's Executive Director, Bridget Blom-Ramsey. Thanks for joining us, Bridget.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
And first, to your practiced eye, what are the standout findings of this survey?
Well, the poll clearly shows that voters believe education early childhood through post-secondary is critically important for Kentucky's progress forward. An interesting thing as we look at the poll results as a whole is that jobs in the economy came in second place, right below healthcare. And voters seem to clearly be connecting jobs and the economy with the availability of childcare and attainment of post-secondary degrees and credentials, which position individuals to be competitive in the workforce. So while we may hear from some that jobs in the economy are not likely to be an issue in the gubernatorial campaign, it seems that voters are saying the exact opposite, that this is critically important, and they see the connection of education to jobs in the economy.
We're about a month into the school year, and going back to school can be a scary thing for kids. There's the peer pressure, homework, tests hit them. One quarter of Kentucky children who are living below the federal poverty level face far more basic fears as they return to school, not having the supplies they need to learn or not knowing where they'll get their next meal, especially on weekends. It's some 60 hours with that kind of uncertainty. What do people in your survey say about helping low-income working parents gain access to quality childcare and preschool?
It's really a wonderful standout statistic in the poll, Tom, that 83% of voters surveyed are in favor of providing high-quality childcare to working families. So they understand that families need support and that just as importantly, our young people need support to be successful in the early years as much as they do in the K-12 years.
Did the poll explore whether or not people are willing to back that up with the costs?
It's always challenging when you pose increased taxes to support an issue like this in a poor state like Kentucky, where people really feel stretched thin. They clearly see the linkage between the investment and what you get for the investment. So they're more likely in that regard, but by and large want to see the government make good decisions with the dollars that are available and understand the return for that investment.
Most of those polled think teacher salaries are too low. But what are the sentiments when it comes to raising the revenue, again, by raising taxes to improve pay for public school teachers?
Well, same thing. I think voters understand the linkage between what we do with public dollars and the return that's expected, either through public education, early childhood, or post-secondary. So they understand the value of these things, and they want to see greater investment. When it comes to taking more money out of working families' pocketbooks through taxation, that's where you see some concern. But voters do understand the linkage between the state's investment and what they get for it.
We have a teacher shortage in Kentucky, nearly 5,000 open positions, according to the Kentucky Educator Placement Service. The State Commissioner of Education has launched a recruiting campaign and asserts that this is not limited to Kentucky, it's nationwide. But this does come at a time when teacher anxieties over pensions, politics, which have been quite angry at times, pay and the pursuit of test scores are being cited as leading reasons for a teacher exodus. There also has been a decline in education degrees being awarded to future teachers. What are you seeing and what do you think are the consequences?
The consequences could be severe if we don't have young people going into teaching. And so I think the value of the profession has been eroded because of our very public tension over the issues of things like pension between the governor and teachers the last couple years. And I think that scared some future teachers off. The other thing that I think is important is compensation. So young people are looking at the opportunities that they have in front of them. If they're high performing in math or the sciences, as an example, they may choose those pure routes to apply their skills rather than choosing a route in teaching that allows them to apply their skills in mathematics and the sciences. So I think we have to recognize that compensation needs to be at a professional level and needs to provide the opportunity for a young person to make decisions about what they want to do with their time and be compensated for that appropriately. In the poll, 61% of voters indicated that teacher salaries are too low. So they understand that teachers are not being compensated at a level that is commensurate with other professions, and that needs to change. Valuing the profession needs to change. When it comes to teaching in the classroom, we need to value the craft. We also need to understand that teachers need time with each other to come together as professionals, to collaborate around curriculum and assessment. And typically, we don't give them that time. We expect them to be managing a class or teaching from the time the doors open until the doors close. And they need time to come together and work together as professionals.
Do you think this adversarial relationship that has developed between the governor and our public school teachers can be overcome?
It has to be overcome as we move forward, because the future of the profession relies heavily on the value that we as Kentuckians place on those individuals choosing to teach in our public schools. And so to attract the best and the brightest into the profession in the coming years, we need to come together as Kentuckians, heal that wound, and commit to progress in our public schools through the most important input, and that is our teachers.
I've seen some interviews with some public school teachers who say that statewide testing doesn't accurately evaluate the success of the student or the teacher, for that matter, and they cite this as another reason for this teacher shortage. Do you have a position on that?
So one thing we don't assess that is so very important for our young people to develop is the skills and the competencies that are required of them, whether they go straight into career or they go into college. And those skills and competencies are things like critical thinking, problem solving, communication, creativity. Those are the things we don't assess on a test. So when teachers say tests don't accurately reflect what students know and can do, they're exactly correct. And we're not valuing at present those skills that our young people need to be successful into the future now and 30 years from now. So we need to do a better job at allowing our teachers to provide learning opportunities in the classroom that value development of those skills. We need to do a better job signaling to our students that those skills are critically important so they can begin to develop those skills in themselves and understand the value of those skills in the marketplace.
I'm wondering if you found from that survey how prepared people in Kentucky think students are for the workplace or for college.
Mm-hmm. And this is something we know, and so it wasn't a surprising finding in the poll, but 40% of voters responded that they feel students graduating from high school are not prepared for their next step. So conversely, about 58% find that high schoolers are prepared. So we have work to do to make sure that that high school diploma is evidence of preparation for a young person's next steps. And Tom, it comes back to the 21st century skills that I just talked about in better providing for our youth opportunities to develop and showcase those skills.
In just a few minutes, we're going to hear from Aaron Thompson. He's the president of the Council on Post-Secondary Education, on what he has learned so far as he conducts listening tours all across the state. Your poll found that voters strongly recognize the need for continuing education after high school, but a solid majority, 77%, believe public university tuition in Kentucky is either much or somewhat too high. Can you elaborate on those findings?
So what we've seen over about the past decade, Tom, is a decline in state investment and almost an equal increase in the price for college, so the cost of tuition. So families and students are bearing the burden of that disinvestment currently, and they're feeling it. Middle-income families, middle-income students are feeling a particular squeeze, and I think that's what Dr. Thompson is hearing on his listening tour, that it's becoming increasingly difficult for them to pay the cost of college. Not only tuition, but the costs of other things students need, living, food, transportation, those sorts of things as they're in college. So we need to ask the question about our investment and ensure that that investment is allowing students to afford college. We also need to help students better understand the value of a college education, that investing in your college education is a many-year investment that pays dividends over the long run. And helping students understand that, that it's not just the cost today, but it is the return that they get for that investment. Those two things we need to better communicate about.
Do you think there's a disconnect in understanding the relationship between the state's disinvestment and the rising tuition and costs?
You know, I don't know that there's a disconnect there because I think families are feeling it. Students are feeling it. Do they understand the intricacies of the state budget and what's happened specifically as a result of disinvestment? Possibly not. But I think what we're going to begin to see in Kentucky and will become known to families and students is other states are reinvesting in post-secondary education because they understand the critical importance of increasing the number of folks in their state with a college degree or credential. Kentucky is not doing that. Our largest border state, Tennessee, has increased investment in post-secondary by double digits. I believe a larger reinvestment than any other state in the nation. And this is our longest border state. So families and students will begin to notice and pay attention that other states are reinvesting while Kentucky continues to disinvest. Hopefully that will turn around in the 2020 legislature.
In an op-ed published this summer, you note that education is singularly important to the Commonwealth's economic future and quality of life. You write that we must not erode this capacity any further, and you urge the governor and the General Assembly to come to a quick and sustainable resolution to this pressing issue without further delay. Are you optimistic?
Tom, I have to admit that I'm concerned about where we are presently. Kentucky has made great strides in education in the last generation. We've climbed from the bottom of the national rankings to roughly the middle, depending on what indicator you look at. That's amazing progress. And it happened as a result of all different stakeholders coming together, believing that Kentucky could do better. Today, we look at those numbers and we say, yes, we've made a lot of progress, but we're also, as a state, fifth from the bottom of the nation in poverty. So as we look forward, we know education is the key ingredient to ensuring that Kentucky now begins to climb the ladder and reduce poverty so that we will no longer be at the bottom of the national rankings in poverty. And that's going to require us to come together to reinvest in education from early childhood through post-secondary and to put the right measures in place so we're actually educating students with, again, the skills and the knowledge that they're going to need in an economy that any of us can barely imagine. So they'll need to compete in an entrepreneurial and an innovative economy that requires critically important skill sets of them. And we need to invest in developing those skill sets so that we can compete, yes, globally, we can compete with other states, our citizens can compete, and we can decrease poverty and move from the bottom of the nation to the middle and the top in both income and education.
Bridget Blom-Ramsey is Executive Director of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, and we thank you, Bridget.
Thank you, Tom.
After a brief break, what Kentuckians have to say about going to college.
So we found out we are actually not advertising the net cost, what it really costs to go to college. They're only seeing the sticker price, and that's scaring them. So there's a perception of affordability or lack of affordability as much as anything else.
And later in the hour, a rare opportunity to tap into a book in progress, the second from EKU President Michael Benson. It traces the origins of the American Research University and what these institutions have given us.
Lasers, Columbia University. The algorithm for Google, Stanford. Magnetic resonance imaging, Columbia. Fetal monitoring, Yale. Gatorade, University of Florida. The nicotine patch, UCLA. Humidin, University of Wisconsin. The origins of computers. A lot of people like to lay claim to that, so Iowa State, Penn, Michigan, Stanford. Methods of surveying public opinion, University of Chicago. That's just a very partial list.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or on the WEKU mobile app. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
What do Kentuckians want in their public universities and community colleges? Well, maybe the best way to find out is to sit down with people across the state and listen to them. As president of the Council on Postsecondary Education, Aaron Thompson has been doing just that. He has completed the first round of his listening tour and now has the second leg underway. Welcome, Aaron.
Thanks, Tom.
First, if you could tell us where you've been.
Well, you know, I feel like I've been all over. I'm starting off the listening tour in my hometown of Manchester and talking with the community members there and some higher ed folks and P-12 folks and a variety of people back in February. I've been to Owensboro, Western Kentucky, around Bowling Green area. I've been to far Western Kentucky, Murray State, Paducah area, Kentucky State, Owensboro. And I've got coming up Eastern Kentucky University, Moorhead, Campbellsville, University of Louisville, University of Kentucky. And these are my bases, but we are bringing people in from all over the place, not just the university folk we're talking with.
Okay, you're about halfway through your whole listening project, and you've had a little bit of downtime here to kind of absorb what you've heard so far. Does anything really leap off the page?
You know, a lot of things are leaping off the page. Let me first of all say that the constituency we're talking with, business and industry, we're talking to students and parents. And we're talking to higher education officials and the students who are in our post-secondary institutions. And one of the things we're finding out, and Tom, as you all know, I'm going out in the state talking about the value of education, the value of higher education. I'm talking about truly why we should be looking at this as a public good. And we have about 53.3% of our high school graduating seniors moving on to post-secondary. That's a low percentage. We can't attain what we need to in the state economically unless we get more people with a post-secondary credential that matters. So I wanted to find out why. And I found out a lot of interesting things. You know, we talk about affordability. What I found out helped me to operationally define exactly what people meant versus sometimes what we mean when we talk about that.
Well, let's continue with that. What did you learn about affordability?
Well, first of all, we had some understanding. We have good data and we have good analytics. We know that some students really don't have the money or as much as they should have to go to college. And we know the rising cost of college has created some issues for many students. But we went out there and found out that what was, you know, middle kids, we call it, parents who are working class families that may not get as much of need-based aid that they need from the federal government and state government, and may not be the kids who are going through the roof on their test scores or getting all the scholarships. Many of these folks are telling us that they don't believe they can afford to go to college. And what we found out is a part of this affordability comes down in sort of two ways in our operational ways of thinking about it. One is the perception that college is too expensive. So we found out we are actually not advertising the net cost, what it really costs to go to college. They're only seeing the sticker price, and that's scaring them. So there's a perception of affordability or lack of affordability as much as anything else. And then there's the real affordability that just doesn't happen with our low-income kids, but that are happening with our middle-income kids who start college but yet can't finish it once they go to college because they run into debt. And so that, and many are getting scared of this borrowing of money, if you will, to make it happen.
And so far in this new century, graduate income has remained relatively flat while tuition has been going up, and the end result is graduating with that debt burden, with perhaps an income that doesn't shoulder its proportionate share of the debt. So you can see why people would figure that they couldn't afford it.
Absolutely. And I talk about this openly. I just tweeted about it today, that if you borrow money, and if you borrow the correct amount of money for the degree or credential that you're getting, and you get that degree and credential, and it gets you a sustainable wage job to pay it back, then that's a good investment. But what we're finding is that many of the folk who are not paying back or who shoulder with this debt are people that didn't get that credential, or a student that borrowed more money than that credential could pay off with. And so that's an issue, too. So we have to be more nuanced in the way we're giving information to these possible borrowers as they're thinking about what they're doing, and let them know that this job can get you this amount once you get out of school.
Kentucky's only one of five states in the whole country that has cut state spending on public higher ed. How are our universities getting by? How are they maintaining under these conditions?
Well, good question. For 11 years now, we've been cut. And we've been cut about $222 million, nominal dollars, from our higher ed budget. And that translates to about $437 million when you consider inflation, because costs do go up no matter what. And what we've done is we've raised tuition, Tom, but we've only raised tuition to cover about 60% of the nominal cost. So this has created some real issues around even what we had to do on campuses. Now, it's been said that we had fat, and in fact, we probably did. But we've been cutting for so many years that fat's been gone. So what you've seen, you've read a lot about, we're cutting deep into the program cuts. We're cutting many of these student support services that we had that supported students in getting what they need. You see the rising need for mental health counseling now. And let me tell you, it's kind of hard to find the dollars in the budget to do that. So we've been cutting. We've been efficient. And we've been, although raising tuition, we've been limiting the percent that we would allow campuses to raise their tuition, because we know that it's going to get unaffordable for that student.
For many years, there was an emphasis on STEM, on science, technology, engineering, and math, and there was indeed a great migration to STEM disciplines. Now it's turning out that the proportion has shifted far away from such majors as education. And that's happening at a time when we are experiencing quite a shortage in public teachers in Kentucky. What are the implications of this? And do people, when you're out there listening, do they seem concerned?
You know, they do. Let me give you what I clearly believe has to be the truth for us to realize in this state to get where we need to go. We do need more STEM degrees. We need more people in health occupations. We need more people that's concentrating on how to build the state's infrastructure, not just of today, but for the future, to create jobs that will, in fact, we haven't thought about existing yet, that will need to be there. With all that said, we have to understand one of the more and maybe the most important profession we have is to have good people going into teaching, doing an effective job. We are building the most valuable commodity that we have, and that's our children's brains. And that's who's going to be in our future. And what I think we've done, we haven't really sold how good the profession of teaching is and the value of that profession very well. That's one thing. We also haven't really put the kind of dollars into teaching we needed to make sure we get our most effective teachers in our classrooms in places that they need to be. We haven't done a very good job, in my opinion, of getting teachers of color in the classroom. We have to refocus our attention on building the teacher preparation programs that will get the best quality that we can get in front of the kids that we need to have ready for our future.
We're also talking in this hour with Bridget Blom-Ramsey of the Pritchard Committee, which is out with a survey that shows that most of us Kentuckians do think that teachers are deserving of higher salaries than they're getting now. But at the same time, we don't seem all that willing to pay for higher salaries through taxes.
Well, I promise you, and if we're not thinking about building the conditions and the professions that we need to build to get Kentucky where we need to go, then we're going to be lagging for a long time. We're going to be at the bottom in many of these areas we don't want to be at the bottom in. And without a doubt, once again, we have to focus on building our STEM and all those areas. But we also have to focus on this holistic way of building humanity. We have to focus on our arts and humanities, our social sciences, and we have to double down on focusing on the importance of good teacher education and good teachers in our state. And we have to do this. This is not a partisan argument, by the way. This is truly an argument that is having to take place no matter who you are and where you're at. I mean, this is a crucial time, and our data are showing that we need to be doubling down on this conversation.
Before we run out of time, I want to bring it back around to your listening tour. Are these listening sessions providing you with any insights that you hadn't anticipated that surprise you?
You know, I mentioned earlier the affordability. That really helped us to hone in on it. The other thing, too, we found out when we talked to employers, they're all on board being with us. They are all on board in creating internships and work-based learning experience. They're on board with allowing us to think about what we need to do. We also found out that many of our kids taking dual credit, we are offering more of that than ever. But many are taking dual credit courses that doesn't help them. So how do we build pathways for them for those courses to matter? We also are needing to have this conversation more openly about how students can go to college, the need of getting kids thinking about college early in their, you know, seventh, eighth, ninth grade, getting them to focus on what it looks like to have a career once they get out. And we also need to understand that universities and colleges are hotbeds for good regional cooperation and good regional economic development. And they're asking us to be partners with them, business and industry and families. The other thing I will tell you is, and I talk a lot, but I've been listening more than talking on these tours in which I argue, they really were in need of having, so we've been having hundreds of people come out because they know that, in fact, higher education is important. However, we have not done a very good job, Tom, and I learned this, so we haven't done a very good job in talking about higher education. We've kind of kept ourselves quiet here, and it's time for us to open our mouths and let people know that this is exactly what's needed for Kentucky. You don't have a strong economic development state without having a strong higher ed system, and we need to be getting out there making that a part of all of the conversations that are happening within these regional communities.
Aaron Thompson, he's president of the Council on Postsecondary Education. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate you.
Listen.
In a moment, we're joined by EKU President Michael Benson. He has a new book underway. It takes us back to the origin of the modern American research university and the many vital things we take for granted today.
Every single day, every single American has their life positively impacted by what has grown out of a research university, maybe not so many, maybe just a regional comprehensive like in Eastern Kentucky.
And we have a new edition of the show. You'll hear it in just a moment. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We're talking with Eastern Kentucky University President Michael Benson. Dr. Benson has his second book in the works, entitled Every Epoch Requires a Fresh Start, Daniel Coit Gilman and the Birth of the Modern American Research University. It follows College for the Commonwealth, A Case for Higher Education in American Democracy, co-authored with former colleague Hal Boyd. That book appeared in 2018. He joins us to discuss his new work. Thanks for coming in, Dr. Benson.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tom.
So first, who was Daniel Coit Gilman?
Well, I was on the campus of Johns Hopkins about a year ago with a former colleague, Nick Perlick. We had a free afternoon. I've always been fascinated with the university founded in 1876 by Mr. Hopkins, Johns Hopkins. Johns is an unusual first name, but that was his mother's maiden name, who was not a college graduate, made his fortune in stock and investments in the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad and dry goods, was a really astute businessman, but didn't have any heirs to speak of, and gave his money to two things. He gave it to various philanthropies, but the bulk of his wealth he left in equal amounts to a hospital and to a university, $7 million in 1872 when he died.
And if That's you, a lot of money
that
back then.
Yeah, the equivalent today would be about $150 million.
Wow.
So at the time, it was the largest gift in the history of American higher education in our country, so there were no strings attached. He designated who he wanted to be his trustees, but he said, you're free to decide how this university is going to be established. And so they came up with the bylaws. They came up kind of with the structure, but then they realized to really launch this enterprise, they had to have just the right person. So they polled three university presidents, the president of Michigan, president of Angel, president of Cornell, president White, and the president of Harvard, President Elliott. And to a person, they said, your man happens to be the president right now at the University of California, Daniel Coit Gilman. He was a Yale-trained geographer who ran the library for a little while. He also ran what was known as the Sheffield Scientific School. So American higher ed in the 19th century, early 18th century, really were theological schools. They trained people to go into the clergy or to be educators. So if they wanted to go into hard science, oftentimes they had to go to a different part of the university. At Yale, it was called the Sheffield Scientific School. And he taught there. And interestingly enough, his friend at Cornell, the president there, President White, Andrew White, they were at Yale together as undergrads. Both of them secured, if you can believe it, in the 1860s, Morrill land grant money for their private institutions, one for Yale, one for Cornell, when really it was designated for public entities, but they were shrewd enough and astute enough to get it for Cornell and for Yale. And again, to fast forward to how I got on the topic and who he was, he got recruited to go to California when these three presidents told the trustees, he's your man to start this university in Baltimore in 1875 is when it launched. He was inaugurated in February of 1876.
And what was it about him that made him stand out to them?
Well, I've found that kind of the patrician group there on the East Coast, they all knew each other. They all kind of went to Harvard or Yale or Princeton. And they were all kind of groomed, very interestingly enough, to be public servants. And he came from a very religious background, Mr. Gilman did. He had an older brother that was a minister, large family. His father was a well-to-do merchant. But his parents inculcated into him this belief that God had given him a lot. They had given their family quite a bit. And he had this responsibility to go out and do something with it.
Noblesse oblige.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, how many graduates, you know, here's a 22-year-old graduate of Yale in the early 1840s, launches off for Europe for 3 years, and he's deputized as a delegate to the Russian royal court. He tours all of the universities in England and France and Germany, and I've gone through his journals, and to see a man of that age, a young man of that age, to have a defined kind of sense of destiny, if you will, he wasn't just doing it for travel, just for kicks and giggles. I mean, he really had a sense of purpose. And he'd write these letters back. Back in those days, they had beautiful penmanship.
They did, yes.
Oh, my word. And these letters back to his parents were so detailed of, I really believe I'm seeing what I need to see. And he was so taken with the German model and their emphasis on scientific research and really putting in the work on the front end to expect something on the back end. And he also loved, the British model of teaching. He spent a lot of time at Oxford. So he came back and tried to implement some of those changes at Yale. And then, of course, he was recruited as the third president at the University of California.
There were these journals, yet there is so very little in the way of published literature about this man. And yet you argue that he, Daniel Coit Gilman, stands as the single most important figure in shaping the American research university. What makes him especially remarkable in your view?
There had been other things written about him in the early 19-teens, one in the 1940s, Fabian Franklin, another gentleman out of Louisville that wrote something about him. But nothing had treated his life cradle to grave, but more importantly, those really seminal years spent preparing for his time at Hopkins that launched, really, Tom, the first research university in the history of the United States. And it was a model that nobody else had tried before. So that travel in Europe where he saw the German model, where, as I said, it was focused on research, and the British model that was all about the tutorial, you know, the seminar method, where I sit down with you as a faculty member, you go over my work, it's very kind of intensive and one-on-one, and then meld those together. And out of whole cloth, they created this research university model that, quite frankly, everybody's tried to replicate. Now, two universities, the latter part of the 19th century, tried to do it just out of whole cloth as well, University of Chicago and Stanford. All the other existing institutions like a Yale, a Princeton, a Harvard, took their undergraduate schools and then just overlaid it with a graduate school. But this was a model that nobody had tried before.
How does that model, how does his work resonate today in today's post-secondary environment?
Well, I'll quote someone who knows a lot more about it than I do, and that's John Thielen, just up the road at the University of Kentucky, considered probably one of the experts on the history of higher education in America, who said Hopkins was the first university of its kind and put in place a model that everybody else has really tried to imitate. So, I mean, what did he do? He put an emphasis on, he said, people and not buildings. That was his big focus. He wanted to go out and hire the very, very best faculty. He wanted to go out and get the best graduate students he could. At first, it was just a graduate program. So he got people like Woodrow Wilson to come and enroll in a PhD program. He was the first to institute graduate fellowships, so enticed newly minted undergrads to come to his place, to Baltimore, and study with young, eager, kind of wanting to prove themselves faculty. So he didn't go after established faculty that were very happily ensconced in Cambridge or in New Jersey or in Chicago or other places. He went and got really kind of young, hungry faculty. The med school came later on in the 1890s, but he recruited what are called the Big Four. And they were four physicians that changed forever medical education in America. They were a pathologist by the name of William Welch, a surgeon by the name of William Halstead, an internist, William Osler, and a gynecologist, Howard Kelly. And if I was at the Hopkins campus a few months ago and in the Welch Library, there's a John Singer Sargent portrait, this literally wall size of these four. And they are considered arguably the greatest, probably academicians in the field of medical education in the history of our country.
So the biography that you're now working on of Daniel Coit Gilman, does this take us from cradle to grave, or is it more about the events in his life that placed him on a path that resulted in the founding of Johns Hopkins?
Well, it's a good question. I think I'm still trying to figure it out. I'm still really in the nascent stages right now. The executive editor at Hopkins says, look, you got to get him born. You got to get him through his undergraduate years. But what we're really interested in is what he did in Baltimore. So I've spent some time in his hometown in Norwich, Connecticut. I spent some time this past summer at Yale at his undergraduate institution. But I'm really trying to get into the formative years, really, the bulk of his time at Hopkins. There's an interesting part, too, of his life. He was, of course, at Yale during the Civil War and took a real keen interest in what was happening to Southern schools immediately after the war, particularly William & Mary. And also, he was part of what was called the John Fox Slater Fund. Now, I didn't know what that was, but it was kind of akin to the Peabody Education Fund. He was very interested in how the Freedmen's Bureau was going to take funds and educate newly emancipated slaves. Hmm. How were African Americans going to get education and then get assimilated into American society? So this Slater Fund, established by a gentleman from Connecticut, $1 million in the early 1870s, which today is equivalent of $23, $24 million. Rutherford B. Hayes was the chairman of the board.
No kidding.
There were five members, and Daniel Coit Gilman was one of them. So he was very interested. You know, Maryland in many ways is considered a southern state. But he was very interested in what higher education was doing, particularly south of the Mason-Dixon line, for those schools that really went through a difficult period during the Civil War and through Reconstruction.
We're talking to Dr. Michael Benson, president of Eastern Kentucky University. And Dr. Benson, this is a question I think that all of us who have even contemplated the idea of writing a book would want to ask you. I know that you hold a doctorate in Middle Eastern history from Oxford, a master's in nonprofit administration from Notre Dame. You're now pursuing a master's of liberal arts from Johns Hopkins, and you're writing a book, and you are leading a regional university through some very interesting times, to say the least. The notion of adding a book to the day job is daunting for most of us. How do you do this? How do you manage all that?
Well, I'd say first and foremost, I have a very supportive wife and understanding children. I think it's important for my kids to see that their dad is always trying to learn. And we have a house that's filled with books, and we put an emphasis on education. But I try my best to pursue projects, too, that have applicability to my day job. I mean, the course I'm taking independent study this fall is on the Civil War, and it's taught by Dwayne Cummins, who is the former president of Bethany College. And the paper I'm going to write for it is going to be a segment. It will actually be a book chapter, I hope, on Daniel Coit Gilman and the Slater Fund, the Peabody Fund, some of these other initiatives during Reconstruction and his emphasis on some of those projects. So I'm always trying to look for overlap. And it's certainly, you know, Tom, as you look, and I brought some notes with me because the Pew Research Center just came out with statistics and a new survey that shows this really growing divide among Democrats and Republicans in their view of higher education and their skepticism of it. And that really worries me.
What do the stats show?
They show that there's this growing divide between registered Republicans and Democrats and their view of colleges. Are they worth it? What are students being taught? Are the faculty predisposed to force their views on students? And as a result, the support for public education, higher education, is eroding. Mm-hmm. And so there's this dichotomy between the fact that in many communities, like in Kentucky, higher education is the, in so many communities, it is the linchpin. Think about Moorhead, where you grew up.
Sure.
Think about Moorhead without Moorhead State.
The Moorhead would not exist.
Think about Richmond without Eastern Kentucky University.
Would not exist.
Think about Danville without Center College. So as I read these stats, I jotted down a few things that have come out of research universities back to the model that, that Hopkins came up with in the latter part of the 19th century, and things that you and I use every single day, and the fact that they came out of a campus, lasers, Columbia University, the algorithm for Google, Stanford, magnetic resonance imaging, Columbia, fetal monitoring, Yale, Gatorade, University of Florida, the nicotine patch, UCLA, Cumadin, University of Wisconsin, the origins of computers. A lot of people like to lay claim to that. So Iowa State, Penn, Michigan, Stanford. Methods of surveying public opinion, University of Chicago. That's just a very partial list. But it goes to show that every single day, every single American has their life positively impacted by what has grown out of a research university. Maybe not so many, maybe just a regional comprehensive like in Eastern Kentucky. But some aspect of education, of knowledge, has been taken, perfected, promulgated, and has impacted us every single day. And so I would hope people see the value of higher education, not just for the fact that, yes, our political environment is becoming more shrill, mm-hmm. and people associate with labels campuses, and they say, well, you know, all the faculty there are registered Democrats. Of course, I'm not going to send my child there, or vice versa. You know, that's not what this is about. This is about providing an opportunity for our young people, and I say young people, everybody, because as you know, students today are across a broad spectrum. Having as many chances to have access to education for as many people as possible.
So do you see a direct connection between that and what you're about to write about Daniel Coit Gilman?
I hope so. That's what I really want to do. I want to show that here was a man at the latter part of the 19th century that helped bring to fruition an institution that changed, yes, Baltimore, that part of the country. But you look at the sponsored research that Hopkins does, the federally sponsored research, they're over close to $3 billion a year. Their next closest competitor is the University of Michigan. They're behind them by over $1 billion. And the impact that has, their hospital, their public health, everything. And, you know, it started with this idea that probably nobody knew if it was going to work or not. I really do hope I can show that there's a direct impact today for us in Kentucky and for the rest of the United States. So we can extrapolate lessons that apply to all of us.
Dr. Michael Benson, president of Eastern Kentucky University, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Who?
What?
What?
Where?
Where?
When?
When?
Why?
A new edition to Eastern Standard. Details of events coming soon. Up first, Art Sheckett from our arts partner, Undermain.
I'm here with Chris Smith. Chris, welcome. And tell us something about your festival that you've been organizing for the last few years, and you have another version of it coming up in September.
I am one of the founders of the Tall Sound Music Festival. It is a two-day family-friendly music festival held right on Southland Drive. In fact, the name Tall Sound is an anagram for the word Southland.
How do you spell Tall Sound?
It is T-A-H-L-S-O-U-N-D. It's a funny name, but it's a great festival.
So tell us the big idea about Tall Sound.
Well, it is a two-day family-friendly event, as I said. The idea is for families to come down and enjoy live music, local arts, craft beer, local foods, and celebrate their community with one another.
And where is it going to be held, Chris?
It will be at Olika's Great Lawn, which is directly behind the Olika Temple on Southland Drive. I believe we were the first people to use it in quite some time, but this will be our third year in it. It's got a built-in stage, great facilities, and is local to most folks.
And will there be other amenities at the festival?
You can expect a great amount of food from varying different food trucks. We'll have West 6 representing for a beer. The co-op will be there. I have a number of different artists. We'll do some art installations working with Oracle Tattoo downtown. And in fact, we started a dog-friendly program last year. Critter Sitters of Lexington provides watering stations and waste management bags so that you can bring the entire family, including your four-legged friend.
Give us two or three of the top bands that you're going to have.
Well, we're excited about a couple of local bands. We have Italian Beaches and Emily Waxahara and Letters of Acceptance. But our headliners this year, Saturday, will be Erica Winterstrom of the Heartless Bastards fame. game, have a full band playing that day. And on Sunday, we're going to be welcoming Horse Feathers, which is comprised of a couple Lexington legends, Robbie Kissens and Tom Nato, and they'll be closing us out on Sunday.
Fabulous. Now, tell us again, when is Tall Sound Festival?
It is going to be September 21st and 22nd.
What time of days?
On Saturday, the gates will open at noon, and they will close at 10 p.m. On Sunday, it'll be noon to 8.
And how do you get tickets?
Well, check out tallsound.com. You can also stop in at the co-op, as well as CD Central.
Fabulous. Sounds like a great local festival, Chris. I appreciate it. We're all looking forward to it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Tall Sound organizer Chris Smith with Art Shackett of Undermain, online at under-main.com. While the music's happening on Southland, they'll be telling tall tales in Wilmore. Ed Bryson's here with details of the Wilmore Storytelling Festival. Greetings, Ed.
Hey, greetings, Tom. Glad to be here.
Tell us what this festival is all about.
Well, this festival really is focused on Appalachia. It's tales as if the old mountain folks sat around in rocking chairs on the porch and told stories long before there were TVs and radio. And so this is kind of a revival of that kind of entertainment, that kind of cultural happening. But in Wilmore, a little village south of Lexington.
And is the lineup a mix of pro and amateur storytellers?
We have professional storytellers now pretty much consistently through our offering, and they're fantastic. You know, nationally known storytellers and in the Appalachian style.
Okay, where exactly is this happening and when?
Okay, it's September 20th and 21st. We'll start with Ghost Tales on the 20th in the evening, starting at 7 o'clock. And it's in Wilmore, Kentucky, 15 miles south of Lexington, Kentucky, a little village where Asbury Seminary is and Asbury University. And it's a picturesque, beautiful town on the green just beside the village.
And is it a ticketed event?
It's a free event. And we have great sponsors who make that possible for us.
Okay. And if somebody wants to know more, is there a website they can go to?
The best way to get more information is to go on Facebook, More Tales Wilmore on Facebook. And there's a link there to our website. You can get more information there.
Ed Bryson with More Tales Wilmore Storytelling Festival coming up on the 20th and 21st. Thanks, Ed.
You bet. Thank you, Tom.
Tell me a story that I can read. Tell me a story that I believe. Paint me a picture that I can see. Give me a touch that I can feel. So I can be everything I was meant to be. Lord, I need loving.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on esweku.com, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.